Twisted Minds of Nerds to your radio for Thursday, December 13th. This is another edition of Perpetual Notion Machine.
Hello, I'm Will Cushman, and I'm joined in the studio tonight by...
This is Heather.
I'm Kelly.
A whole P&M crew, another edition of Nerds having fun. We thought it was going to be... we thought it was so much fun last time that we have decided to do it again more quickly than we had planned.
Oh, yeah.
But we have a fun night in store, a fun 29 minutes now, almost 28. Ooh, got to get going. Of quizzes and all sorts of stuff, science news. But first, Heather, do you want to kick us off with a special listener question?
Absolutely. So this is for all you listeners out there. We have a special quiz question with prizes. So you can call in during the show and participate in Nerds Having Fun. We got three books to give away. So if you call in and you're one of the first three callers with the right answer, you can choose the books that are available. The first book we have is How to Build a Dinosaur, The New Science of Reverse Evolution, How to Bake Pie, An Edible Exploration of the Mathematics of Mathematics. That's a bit esoteric. And then The Killer of Little Shepherds, A True Crime Story and the Birth of Forensic Science. So these will be your prizes if you call in and you can answer this question. Now, this should be a fairly easy question if you were listening to the last hour of Wart. Jack Williams was being interviewed by our own Nina Krivinsky about the weather in 2030. What era will it feel like? I'm not going to give you multiple choice because it was just on the radio. So call us at 256-2001, 608-256-2001, anytime before, let's say 725, and give us your answer. And you can win one of these great books and play along with us while we have a lot of fun. So let me just restate that question. In 2030, our weather will feel like which era?
And by era, could you clarify a little bit what that means?
Like geologic era?
Any of the scenes.
Ah.
Mm,
okay.
The scenes.
It ends with scene. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Cool. I think that was a good hint. Mm-hmm. Cool. So we also have quizzes for ourselves tonight. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking maybe we can just kind of like sprinkle some of these questions throughout. We can do a quiz question here, a little news tidbit there, a little blind item around the corner.
Sure.
Cool. So maybe let's start. I want to ask five questions prepared, all having to do with science news, science that's been in the news in the last like week or two.
Oh, right.
Maybe 3 weeks. I'm not sure. Anyway, here is the first one.
Okay.
NASA's InSight lander successfully touched down on the surface of Mars on November 26th, so a couple weeks ago now. The lander will probe Mars's interior in an attempt to understand more about the planet's geology, how the planet formed, and how the solar system came to be. The lander touched down in what region of Mars? A. Valles Marineris. B. Elysium Planitia. C. Gale Crater, or D, plantar fasciitis. Sorry,
I believe D is a foot condition.
Hopefully it wasn't a hard landing for that poor little rover.
Do you want me to repeat those one more time?
Yeah.
I'm inclined to go with the Marineris option because it's dinner time.
So the InSight lander landed in what region of Mars on November 26th? Valles Marineris, I don't know how to pronounce it. Elysium Planitia, Gale Crater, or plantar fasciitis?
Definitely not D. Let's rule that out.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Kelly?
I'm going to go, there are craters on Mars. I'm going to go with Gale Crater.
Okay. Kelly's going with Gale Crater.
It's pretty simple.
I want to say Elysium B.
Okay.
Okay.
Heather is correct. Elysium Planitia. So they chose a really, really, really flat area on the equator to land.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, nice sound effect. Because they wanted an area on the equator where they could get plenty of sunlight for the lander's solar panels. So it could... keep going for years. And also they wanted a really, really flat place because they only had one shot to get the lander down and tidy and straight and like not landing all askew. So
very nice.
Yeah.
We have a caller.
Ooh.
Oh, okay. My goodness. We may have just lost the caller. Okay. Well, they had the right answer. That's just for the phone issues.
Phone fail, but we do apparently have a correct answer from a caller. They'll call back.
Okay. Yes. Please call us back. We want to give you this book. And I'll repeat the question if you haven't heard it yet. In 2030, the global weather will feel like which era? And the name of the era ends with in the sound scene. So one of the scene eras. Mm-hmm. So we did have the correct answer, but we didn't get to talk to them. So please call us back. And if you haven't called in, we have three books total to give away. So two winners already.
Jeff and Mike.
Congrats, Jeff and Mike.
Just let Kevin, our engineer, know.
Yes.
Which books you'd like.
Very, very nicely done. All right. We're so happy for you, Jeff and Mike. Thank you very much for calling in.
Yay.
All right.
Kelly, you have some other newsy tidbits over there. Can you tell us what's in store from your twisted mind?
Oh, it's not so much news, but today I would like to talk about, okay, so this... In doing a little research for this, I ended up reading a lot of top 10 things that you didn't know about your body. we've all seen them, right? And we're like, oh, that's interesting. I did a little bit of background reading on some of them. It's because someone has to. So I've got some that I'm going to pose to y'all and the greater y'all out there in Radioland. See how sharp you are about how your body works.
Cool. I'm ready.
Uh-oh. All right. So let's start off with an easy one. Every person has a unique set of fingerprints. Our fingerprints are unique, of course. Correct?
I want to say yes, because that's what I've always mm-hmm. been told. But maybe it's just one of the... I think yes. I mean, yeah.
Can I, like, modify?
You can preface, you can modify, yeah. We can discuss.
I'm gonna say they are largely unique, but the chance that some other human on the planet has a print that matches one of your prints mm-hmm. is pretty high, actually, I would think.
Yeah, and I think that's as a rule of thumb, it generally holds. It holds enough that we use it in the justice system. Take that as you may. So Science Alert, and I'll post this on when this gets posted on the blog. I'll link to these because you gotta have citations. But
for sure.
But according to this, for more than a century, fingerprints have played a major role in forensic investigations. It all started with Scottish scientist and physician Henry Foulds. Faulds, who in 1988 or 1888 wrote an article asserting that each person has a wholly unique set of fingerprints. So some guy in 1888 wrote an article proclaiming this. A single print in the wrong place can be enough for a criminal conviction. However, we have no way to conclusively prove that each of our collections of whorls, loops, and arches is unique, short of gathering the prints of every person who has ever lived and comparing them. So it's impossible to say for sure, and there can be serious consequences if most people believe that fingerprint analysis is invaluable. In 2005, Simon Cole, a criminologist at the University of California at Irvine, published a study detailing the 22 known cases of fingerprint mistakes in the history of the American legal system. So, pardon, but as a rule of thumb, it holds, but... But again, if you're going to be using actual scientific rigor, especially in criminal proceedings, it's very important to understand the length that this goes and that this is an area where, you know, like Will said, I've always heard this and it's mostly true, but is it true enough that you'd stake somebody's life on it? We have science that can provide. Although an interesting tidbit that I did run into is that tongue prints are likely to be very unique. Tongue is a vital organ, and it's possible that the print, the size, the shape of your tongue can be used to individually identify you. Tongues are sexually dimorphic, which is interesting. Women, at least biologically born females have tongues different than biologically born males. And it's also interesting that we enter the realm of science fiction when we consider that not only can the print be used, but the individual's oral microbiome can also be used to individually label people. Our microbiomes are very different from one another. Everybody, even if you cohabitate, it's still different. It's thought that the oral microbiome is different enough that you would be able to use that to identify or discern between individuals.
Huh. Very cool. Really looking forward to the Forensic Files episode where they catch someone based on a tongue print.
Right. Or when you start
See them take a tongue print.
Yeah. I want to log into my phone with my tongue. I just want to lick my phone. Yeah. It's me.
Yeah. But then
someone
steals your phone, they're going to like make you lick it at gunpoint.
Oh! That's a weird episode of television crime shows. I don't know any crime shows.
I love it.
Yeah. Very interesting fact. Thank you, Kelly.
Yeah, that was very cool.
Yeah.
So let's move on a little bit. Listeners who listened to our last Nerds Having Fun episode will remember the blind item segment, or any listeners who also are into like celebrity gossip blogs might also know what blind items are generally. It's where I describe someone based on, in this case, kind of like their life circumstances. Actually, in this upcoming case, it's going to be like mostly about the circumstances of their death. And you're going to have to guess who it is. And all of these people that I've prepared blind items for are famous, relatively famous scientists and or Nobel Prize winners.
Ooh.
And
good clue. So listeners, play along with us.
Okay. So this English mathematician died tragically at the age of 36 from complications of pre-modern cancer treatment, i.e. bloodletting. To compound the tragedy, she was abandoned just months before her death by her husband after she made a confession to him when it became apparent she was dying. No one knows what she confessed. The scientist's childhood was also quite tragic. She was a daughter of a famous English poet who abandoned her and her mother soon after her birth. Her mother was not that much better and essentially handed responsibility for her upbringing to the child's grandmother. Additionally, she was ill throughout much of her childhood, needed bed rest at times for up to a year, and became temporarily paralyzed after contracting measles. She had a real rough life. However, her education continued through her many illnesses, and she eventually married a member of the landed gentry and had three children. So it's there's some upsides.
She turned it around.
Turned it around. Until her tragic early death. She maintained throughout her life a deep interest in science and math and worked closely with another English mathematician on developing a proposal for a calculating machine called the analytical machine. She realized such a machine could be used for more than solving math problems.
I think Kelly's trying to kind of
ring the
bell. I know
it is, but I don't want to continue.
Okay. I only have like one more sentence.
Yeah. So,
and she realized it could be programmed to solve complex problems, hence her designation as the mother of computer programming. She even published the first algorithm intended to be carried out by a machine, all this in the mid-19th century. Who is this amazing woman?
Is it Lady Ada Lovelace?
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Where's the sound? Yeah. Ow. Way to go,
I'm
Kelly.
I'm doing all my own sound effects here.
Stop, Kelly.
No, that's a bad one. That's a good one. There we go. Wow. Got a point.
I was getting signals, I think, from both of you pretty early on that you knew probably
did
who
you,
it was.
I had a guess that turned around pretty quickly to be the wrong person.
Oh.
Yeah, when you hear of like the tragic death of a mathematician.
I thought Alan Turing.
Yeah, a lot.
Oh. Yeah. Yep.
He that's was what, young. I don't know how old he was exactly, but he wasn't in his 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to go with, like, generalities to specifics. So.
You did good. That was a good one. I learned something very wonderful.
Isn't that like doing the research for these blind items was pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good one.
So we could do another quiz question.
I would like a quiz question.
Okay, cool. How about this? This is something that's in the news just from, I think it was announced on Monday. And it's pretty fascinating as well. A group of Dutch researchers recently announced that they have succeeded in growing a certain piece of animal anatomy in the lab. The hope is that the lab-grown anatomy could eventually replace the quote-unquote farming of a certain type of animal for human use. Stem cell biologist Hans Clevers reported on Monday that he and his colleagues were able to successfully grow what?
What is
Oh, wait. Yeah, sorry. This is multiple choice. Or do you think you know the answer?
I know.
Oh.
Does Heather know?
Do you know Heather?
No.
Okay, let's do the multiple choice then.
Okay.
A, they grew pig hearts. B, beaver teeth. C, mink fur. Or D, snake venom glands. So again, that's A, pig hearts. B, beaver teeth. C, mink fur. Or D, snake venom glands.
I am guessing pig hearts.
Okay, we got a pig hearts.
Venom.
Ooh, venom's good too.
Kelly is correct.
Oh,
ding,
yeah.
Ding,
venom.
Ding. Yeah, so these scientists.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Larry called in, and he's a winner of our third book.
Congratulations, Larry.
Thank you, Larry. We are so glad you're listening and playing along with us tonight.
Yeah, so thanks to Mike, Jeff, and Larry all calling in with the correct answer. You all get a book tonight.
Yeah.
What a bunch of smarties.
Yeah, and so I think just housekeeping, if you come to the Wart Studios, you can just pick up your book. We'll leave your names at the front desk in the books. If you have any questions about it, you want to get your book a different way, just call us back and let us know.
Yeah. And we'll do first come, first serve in terms of out the books.
Yeah. You get to pick your book.
Yeah. Cool. So it was
venom.
Snake venom glands. Yeah. So snakes are farmed, venomous snakes are farmed basically to harvest their venom
to make the antidote.
Exactly. Yep. So these scientists are trying to create little, they're not real organs. Not organelle. That's cell related. Organoid, I think, is what they were using in the story I was reading. Organoid. But essentially, they want to grow them so that they can do this all from labs and not have to treat these animals.
They're growing so many animal parts now, though. It's really interesting. I mean, I think I had just seen a headline of a pig part being grown for some medical purpose, but obviously it wasn't pig hearts. But
retinas were another one that was in the news recently too. They're growing like retina replacements.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, also the other complication to getting these kinds of exotic snakes. So the reason that snakes are farmed basically is not just for anti-venoms, but also because the venoms are important pharmaceuticals. Mm. We use snake venoms to first just kind of discover how nerves worked because they interact with the nervous, certain venoms will interact with the nervous system and cause an effect. So therefore, if we can kind of take this pharmaceutical agent and, you know, parlay it to our own uses, that's a great application. So because we need this vast pharmacopoeia and, you know, snakes are living things, but they also don't live very well in captivity. So a lot of these rare snakes, you know, you have to send somebody out to get them. That's expensive. It's dangerous to transport them. A lot of them don't breed well in captivity. Just as an aside, not that I'm plugging the guy's YouTube or anything, but when I need to fall asleep, I watch this guy named Viper Keeper. He's this, I believe he's a Wisconsin man, and he has this whole room full of poisonous snakes, and it's really just him setting the camera up and him, like, yelling at his snakes for 20 minutes while he changes the bedding and, like, yells at his king cobra, whose name is Elvis. It's, like, the best thing ever.
Did Elvis make a mess in the bed?
Oh, Elvis needs, what does he call it? Not stimulation. It's, like, where he lets him just kind of crawl around the house. Like, that's his pet. All the rest of them are ones that he's just sort of keeping in little trays and stuff. So if you're having trouble sleeping... Head on over
and
to
you don't get nightmares.
Head on over to Viper Keeper's YouTube channel to see a grumpy man fussing with his snakes.
And so does he kind of yell at them the way some people talk nice to their plants to help them grow and
or to pets? I mean, like basically, like you're gonna be stubborn now, huh? Because you'll have snakes that have like stuck sheds or something where I'll have to, you know, pull a piece of shed from like a snake's eye. And, you know, a snake doesn't want him doing that. Oh, so he's just like, oh, goodness. We're getting fussy now. it's really endearing.
His name is Viper King on YouTube.
Viper Keeper. Yes.
That
you'll learn
a
lot about
valuable
a snakes.
Scientific resource.
Yes. And all about why harvesting venom glands is very important.
Oh, yeah. That's great aside.
Yay!
Kelly, do you have another thing you want to talk about from your stack of papers over there?
I do. I printed out a bunch of things. Tell me, young man, how many bars of soap can you make from a human body?
Wait, excuse me?
Is it seven? Is the answer seven?
Seven bars of soap from the human body?
Just one human body, oh, only thereabouts. Seven bars of soap? That seems small.
That's the number that I was finding. I was unable to verify this fact, but it seems to be true if you do the calculations.
Please explain your line of inquiry here.
Well, think about BMI. We know that the human body has anywhere from, I think that for healthy, I mean, and again, this is just the BMI, but for males, it's somewhere between, what, like 9 and 15%. For females, it's like 15, 20%.
Oh, it's just your fat.
The percent, right. So if you figure that like a human with 20% body fat weighs like 200 pounds, I mean, that's what, 40 grams or 40 pounds of fat? I don't know if you guys have ever made soap before. If you've made soap, call in now and tell us how many bars of soap you can make from 40 pounds of fat. Or 20 pounds of fat, for that matter. Call it even. Let's call it 30. How many bars of soap can you make? I'm imagining that you'll probably, if you're not careful with your rationing, you probably get about 7 bars of soap out of that.
So my question for Kelly is this something that you just entered into Google, like out of your own curiosity?
Were you watching Fight Club?
Was your curiosity what happened? Peaked?
I found it on a list. And I was like, that can't be true. And I was unable to disprove it, so I put it on the air. Also, from a highly reliable website called didyouknow.org, I found this statement, which also seems to check out. The average human body contains enough potassium to fire a toy cannon.
What? Well, potassium's important. I would believe
Wait,
that.
But what qualifies as a toy cannon? That doesn't seem that impressive to me, actually.
We got to break this apart. I know, what is a toy cannon? How big? And why is it the first thing that comes to mind? Like, enough potassium to, like, I don't know. Like, I guess to fertilize a plant for a year. No, like, to fire a toy cannon. Enough phosphorus to make 2,200 match heads. This is how much the average human body, if you were to kind of, like, separate you from your parts.
All our minerals.
Enough carbon to make 900 pencils. Fat enough to make 7 bars of soap or 75 candles. Iron. Enough iron to make a 7.5 centimeter nail. Water, which is 70% of your body, is enough to fill a 10-gallon tank. And enough sulfur to kill all the fleas on an average dog.
Okay, I just got to break in here.
Head over to didyouknow.org for more impressive facts about the human body.
PNM is really, really, really fun. So if you want to get in on making radio and having a good time and learning about science, please join us. We have a new email address. What's our email address?
Oh, you put me on the spot. It's scienceonwart@gmail.com.
Yeah, so we want you to come join us in this effort of making great science radio. So shoot us an email. You can always call the station and ask how to get involved at 608-256-2001. But it is truly a very good time, and we want you to be a part of it.
It is. Whether you're on the air or in the like engineering or just hanging out, contributing story ideas, like we will welcome any type of volunteer participation.
Yeah, yeah.
But especially if you want to be on the air.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Would you like to do one more blind item?
Yes.
Okay. So here's another one. And I actually don't think that this one is a Nobel Prize winner, but he is a scientist.
Okay.
Rocket scientist in particular. So this American rocket scientist was instrumental in the founding of the federal government's famed Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He was also a devout occultist. He grew up wealthy in the Los Angeles area, living in a house with his mother and grandparents and several domestic servants on an avenue in Pasadena known as Millionaire's Mile. He was not a very social kid, had few friends, and was a voracious bookworm, being particularly interested in mythology and science fiction. A terrible student, he was sent to a military academy in high school, but he didn't last long there. He was expelled after blowing up a toilet. He eventually sorted himself out academically.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, right. He eventually sorted himself academically and became obsessed with developing rocketry technology. He even pursued a degree in chemistry at Stanford before dropping out for financial reasons, the family's money having mostly dried up at that point. Eventually, he and a friend insinuated themselves into a group of researchers at Caltech developing advanced rocketry. This work eventually led to the founding of JPL and newfound wealth for this scientist, who bought a large house and advertised rooms for rent, specifying that only bohemians, artists, musicians, anarchists, and other quote-unquote exotic types need apply.
Of course.
Yep. Yeah. Soon, science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard...
Sounded like an L. Ron Hubbard situation.
Right. Who is also, for those who don't know, the founder of the Church of Scientology, moved into this guy's house.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And the two became close friends. It was during this time that the rocket scientists embraced the occult and began performing elaborate rituals, which included masturbating onto quote unquote magical tablets accompanied by a violin concerto. Sorry, I should have had a little trigger warning there. Later in his life, he worked for another prominent aircraft company, was investigated by the FBI under suspicion of spying for Israel, and planned to move to Mexico. He died in 1952 before he could move, however, when a shipment of explosives blew up part of his house. Who was he?
Oh, he was also friends with Aleister Crowley. Like that, And there's suspicion that he died under suspicious circumstances. How would this famous, you know, like thorough rocket scientist, like how would he just blow himself up? Oh, is it James?
Close. It's a J name.
Jack.
Yes, Jack.
Jack.
Oh, you're so close.
Peaches.
Oh my, close. It's a P. Jack.
Palance. No.
Peaches. Jack.
Dick.
Parsons! You are so close. Oh my God, yeah.
We figured it out.
That was great.
Have you ever heard of Heather? Are you familiar with this gentleman?
I'm not familiar with this gentleman, but I want to hang out with him. And yeah. I don't know what it was, but something about like the occult and the bohemian house and the blowing stuff. It just felt L. Ron Hubbard-y. Like it felt the natural best friend of L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah.
In fact, I was wondering if L. Ron Hubbard had dabbled in science.
He dabbled in pseudoscience.
That was a good question.
This guy was totally bonkers, but also like quite influential.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love the story
pants.
Of like, yeah. He got kicked out of school for blowing up that toilet, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, kids today, they do something like outrageous and then everybody's worried that they've got some sort of issue, but maybe they're just a burgeoning scientist exploring.
And to be fair, he did die in a house explosion. So the naysayers weren't wrong.
They weren't wrong, but they didn't know what he'd accomplish along the way.
It's the journey, not the destination.
It's the journey.
Well, I think we're just about out of time.
Can I tell you one more fact?
Yes, please.
Go for it.
Cornflakes have more genes than people do.
What?
It's true. Because of the way that wheat was farmed, it has more chromosomes. Plants can do this weird thing. So when you think of humans and their chromosomes, you think of the chromosome spread. You see those two little wiggly worms that are stuck next to one another. A lot of plant species can use three of those. So through the process of hybridization, wheat acquired all these extra genes, duplicated its genome. And so now it has, I think, humans have anywhere from 2,000 to 25,000 genes. And... the recently sequenced wheat gene was characterized as having about 107,000 genes. So cornflakes have more genes than humans do. Biology sure is weird.
Amazing. On that fascinating note, we want to thank everyone who listened tonight. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thanks again to Heather and Kelly for joining me. And thank you to Kevin Lauder-Young for engineering. I'm your host and producer of tonight's show, Will Cushman.